Hello and welcome to episode 2.16, the April 19th, 2023 Grass is Greener edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. I used to think of March as the transition month from winter to spring, but these days it seems April now lays claim to that title. Early April brings with it the last lingering possibility of significant snow, and breaking out your snow shovel is just as likely as breaking out your pruning shears. But as the month moves forward, nature begins to pop, as yellow daffodils and forsythia bloom, pink dogwood flowers blossom, and the grass becomes thicker and greener. By the time the end of April comes along, I am usually scrambling to make sure my mowing equipment is in shape, cursing myself for having neglected to properly maintain my lawn machines, and hauling out the summer tires from the basement to swap with the winter tires on the car. As the grass around here gets greener, it's always a good time to get out and enjoy a different color of grass in the form of bluegrass music. Everything about bluegrass music heralds days of sunshine and warmth, and the 1891 Fredonia Opera House has just the ticket in the form of a concert by Monroe Crossing, a bluegrass band based in Minnesota. I caught up with Derek Johnson, the lead singer and guitar picker for Monroe Crossing, for a chat about the upcoming concert. It's always very exciting to talk to musicians. It's one of the best parts about being someone who does a podcast. And with me now, I have Mr. Derek Johnson. And Derek is one of the members of Monroe Crossing. They'll be coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, April 28th at 7:30 p.m. They're a straight-up bluegrass band, and it'll be good to hear some of their music. So, Derek, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Derek is the guitar player for the band, and of course, the band consists mostly of pretty much straight up bluegrass music. We've got guitar, bass, fiddle, mandolin, and banjo, all five instruments, and you guys play pretty much straight up bluegrass songs, yeah?
Well, we do for the most part. We consider ourselves, you know, grounded in the traditional bluegrass. We like to write a lot of songs. So, some of those are, you know, have a more modern bluegrass sound, and kind of have our own flair to it. And then, we do like to every once in a while bring in a song from outside of the genre and give it a nice bluegrass twist. We call it the cleansing. That's what we call it.
The cleansing. That's great. I actually did in my research, listened to you guys do a version of the Everly Brothers' "Wake Up, Little Susie." It was pretty cleansing experience for me.
Okay, great. That's a fun one.
Yeah, I imagine it is. Now, you guys are from the Minnesota area. How did a bluegrass band ever get started up in the cold wilds of Minnesota up there? We usually associate bluegrass with Kentucky, Tennessee, and a lot of the Appalachian South.
It is true. Yeah, there's a lot of bands in that area of the country that you just mentioned, but we do have a very strong bluegrass community up here in Minnesota, and we have a nice organization called Minnesota Bluegrass and Old Time Music Association, and that's where that brings a lot of great musicians together. There's a lot of different bands that are bluegrass and spinoff, you know, string bands and whatnot, and so it's a thriving community even up here in the Great White North.
Do you guys feel that bluegrass tradition up there has something distinct about it that might be a little bit different from, say, the bluegrass traditions in Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina?
Yeah, it's a good question. We do have a little different sound up here. We have a wider variety. If you go to a festival, usually a lot of the festivals in the heart of the bluegrass country are just kind of nonstop traditionally minded or contemporary bluegrass bands here. I think it's because, as I mentioned, the Great White North, because we're covered in snow most of the year. We have a lot of people who are great musicians who come to bluegrass as their first form of music, because we're stuck inside playing music most of the year. So So we kind of bring a lot of different elements and a lot of different styles of music into the bluegrass. There's a handful of very traditionally minded bluegrass bands here, but really runs the gamut.
I noticed that talking about tradition, you guys are called Monroe Crossing, and of course you've named yourself after the founder of bluegrass, Bill Monroe. How'd that come about?
Well, we're big fans of Bill Monroe, and we were looking for a name that said bluegrass without the word bluegrass in it, and hearkening back to the father of bluegrass music, and we came up with Monroe Crossing, and then after the fact, we kind of decided, hey, it's a great way to. We also say that we all connected through the music of Bill Monroe, so we ourselves had a Monroe Crossing.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good name, I thought. I said Monroe Crossing, Bill Monroe. You know, I mean, I think just about every bluegrass player in the country for the last 50 years before he died in 1994 probably played with Bill Monroe at some particular point in time.
Yeah.
He got around. You guys, not only though, I mean, I was looking at your schedule and I noticed that you spend almost the entire summer in Minnesota, but you're not like just a regional bluegrass band. You guys have been around. You've traveled internationally and so forth. What is the bluegrass scene like internationally? I hardly ever get a chance to talk to anybody who has any connection to that.
Sure. Yeah. We mainly play in the upper Midwest, like as you mentioned, especially during the summer, because there's so much going on here at that time, but we'll travel far and wide. We've just recently played in Maine, and that was, we now have played in every one of the lower 48 states.
Congratulations.
But thank you. And, as you mentioned, we also have traveled internationally. We've played Europe, multiple times. We've been in maybe about 4 tours of Europe, even made our way to, South Korea, for some shows, with another project we kind of do called the Bluegrass Mass, which we can talk about later. But, to answer your question, bluegrass, you know, it's just touched every part of the world, it seems like, and there's always some bluegrass fan somewhere on the far corners of the world. And in Europe, they have a great scene. We've done a lot of our touring in Germany, and we've done a bit in Holland, and Switzerland. And we last time we were there, we were in the Czech Republic. And if believe it or not, the Czech Republic has outside probably the United States has some of the finest bluegrass pickers out there.
Wow. Yeah. I was really fascinated by that. They're amazing. Yeah.
They're amazing. I mean, it's just the whole country is just embraces music in general. I mean, if you visit Prague or whatnot, there's all sorts of concert halls, all sorts of clubs and venues, whether it be jazz or acoustic music and bluegrass. Really interesting thing is, of course, you know, they used to be a communist controlled country. And even then they were into bluegrass music, but they kind of had to do it on the sly because it was a bit too Western. And they couldn't, for instance, they couldn't sing in English, which most Europeans do when they sing bluegrass bands or bluegrass songs. The Czech had to sing in Czech. And so when we were over there, it was just fun to hear a lot of the bluegrass standards sung in Czech.
I can't imagine a standard like Way Downtown Fooling Around being sung in Czech.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And of course, they sing a lot in English now.
Of course.
But back in the day, they had to sing it in Czech. And so they did, and they persevered. And it's amazing how talented the bluegrass musicians are there. In fact, we know a really great guitar player from the Netherlands who actually moved to the Czech Republic because the bluegrass scene was so great there.
Wow. It's something else. That music really has an international flavor. So talk to me about this Bluegrass Map project. I'm interested in learning a little bit more about it.
Sure. That's kind of one of the reasons we're headed out east once again, although we will be playing our normal show in Fredonia. But what we will be doing the rest of the weekend is we'll be heading out to Pennsylvania and collaborating with a choir. And this is called The World Beloved, a Bluegrass Mass. And it was written for choir and a bluegrass band or bluegrass instrumentation as kind of the accompanying instruments for this choral piece. And it's written in the tradition of a musical mass, not a liturgical mass, but in a musical mass, and has what I think 12 movements, and it's spectacular. It really is a modern masterwork. We've done it over 80 times now. That's what brought us to South Korea, and as well as Carnegie Hall twice, and to so many different places throughout the country. So we get into town, we rehearse with the choir, and we present it. Sometimes we do some other songs with the choir, but the Bluegrass Mass runs about 35 minutes, and it's just a magical piece of work. And it's not easy. There's aspects of it that have, you know, that bluegrass flavor to it, but there's other aspects where we're playing more like classical music. So we've really had to study it and work hard to do it, but it's really paid off.
I've heard sections of it on YouTube videos, and it really does. It's bluegrass in a way you'd never even think of conceiving. It's a unique project.
We love performing it. We love working with different choirs. It takes us out of our usual little world and plants us in a world that we get introduced to so many other talented musicians, and then the audience gets introduced to bluegrass, because a lot of people who are regular choral fans of classical choral music don't necessarily spend a lot of time jamming around the fire picking bluegrass. So we get to introduce people to bluegrass, and we get to be introduced into the classical choral world.
It's an amazing project. Let me ask you one last question before I have to let you go, Derek. Bluegrass is an interesting form of music because it has such strong traditions behind it, you know, but yet at the same time, there have been movements over, I don't know, say the last 10, 15 years with interesting musicians coming out of bands like Nickel Creek, Sarah Watson, and Chris Thiele and a couple of others. Where do you see bluegrass music kind of heading as you see these kind of, you know, advancements in both techniques and also the way it kind of moves itself from just the traditional, you know, melody line, and everybody takes their part in terms of playing their solos and so on?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, it seems throughout the history of bluegrass, there's always been this group of people who are, well, we call them the bluegrass police. And they, you know, if you stray just slightly out of this well-defined boundaries, well, that ain't no part of nothing. That ain't bluegrass. Right. But of course, bluegrass music wasn't bluegrass music when it began. It was just country music. It was kind of amped up country music, and it was Bill Monroe had this driving sound, and then when he added this hotshot young banjo player named Earl Scruggs to the mix, it developed this really unique sound. And it wasn't until years later, because Bill Monroe's band was called the Bluegrass Boys, wasn't years later that they, you know, it got the name bluegrass. So it was always kind of a very innovative music. But there are certain people who say, no, it can only be done this way. And there are still many, many bands, including young bands, who do play a very traditionally minded bluegrass. I think of the Poor Ramblin' Boys. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a great entertaining band. And they do not stray far from the traditions of bluegrass. And then, as you mentioned, Nickel Creek, Chris Thiele, and then so many other bands that have come on the scene lately, and who have made bluegrass very popular outside of the traditional world of bluegrass, and have really brought it. I think of Billy Strings as an example, who has really brought it out almost to the rock and roll jam band type crew. Mm-hmm. Although Billy Strings is very, although he gets some criticism from some bluegrass, not from me, but from some bluegrass people, he is very steeped in the traditions of bluegrass. And as far as I'm concerned, I love all of it. But as long as you can hearken back to kind of the main traditions and, you know, keep it kind of acoustic, and I love all the different kinds. Where it's going, I think it's always going to, like I said, I think it's always going to be tested. I think there's always going to be people who are kind of pushing the boundaries. And I think there's always going to be people who are saying you can't do that. And who want nothing but the three chords and the very straight stuff. But, God bless them all. I love it all.
I think the people who want to keep it the way that it is are, I think I have a name. I think it's called the International Bluegrass Music Association.
Sure.
Yeah, and, but I'm, know, and, I'm allowed to say that. You're not.
Okay. Well, you know, but even like some, even what people would call contemporary bluegrass is, you know, slightly different from some of the more traditional stuff. Mm-hmm. So, there's a formula, but like I said, Bill Monroe wasn't working on a formula when he came up with it. He was breaking boundaries. So, you know, kudos to it all. And I still love like just a straight ahead 2.5 minute hard driving bluegrass tune. That's still one of my favorites, but I'll take the rest, but I still always come back to that straight formula.
Okay. This is the last question, Derek. This is the most important question I'm going to ask you the whole interview. Okay. You ready?
I'm ready.
Tony Rice or Doc Watson?
Oh my goodness. How can you make me choose that? That's not even fair.
I told you it was going to be difficult.
You know what? Yeah. I don't know if I can, I'm just going to say Doc, because I just love the way he would, I don't know. He was a little bit more of an innovator. He was early on innovator. Let's put it that way. If there wasn't Doc, there wouldn't have been Tony. Let's put it that way.
I think you're right. I do think Tony, you're right.
Tony took it to a whole new level and has totally shaped the way bluegrass players play. But if Doc hadn't been picking those old fiddle tunes out on the guitar way back when, you know, what would Tony be standing on? So let's go with Doc.
Okay, we'll go with Doc. All right. Listen, you can't go wrong with either choice, really. Yeah, but, you know, I can understand your reasoning for going with Doc. Listen, Derek, thank you very much. I appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you and Mark and Lisa and Matt. And I'm not really sure which banjo player you're bringing.
That's a good question. We work with a couple of different banjo players now. I think it'll be David Robinson on banjo for this.
David Robinson. Okay. That'll be great. If he shows up, we'll say hi to him too. But, those are the members of the, Monroe Crossing Bluegrass, band. And we'll be glad to have you at the 1891 Opera House on Friday, April 28th at 7:30 PM. Derek, thank you very much. Safe travels to you. And, we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Monroe Crossing will bring their bluegrass stylings to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, April 28th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 general admission, $18 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. Call the box office at 716-679-1891 for tickets, or buy them online at fredopera.org/tickets. Monroe Crossing is sponsored by Folk and Fredonia, the Gilman Family Music Series. The next Live at the Met presentation is a production of the opera Champion, composed by Terence Blanchard, with a libretto by playwright Michael Christopher. This jazz-infused opera tells the tragic story of welterweight Emil Griffith, a boxer in the late 1950s and early 60s, who tragically caused the death of his opponent Benny Parrott during a boxing match for the welterweight title in 1962. This production marks several firsts for the Met as it strives to expand its commitment to inclusion and diversity in its offerings. Here to discuss this effort with me, as well as offer a preview of the opera, is Dan Ehas. Joining me now to talk about the upcoming Live at the Met presentation of Champion is Professor Emeritus of Voice at the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia, Mr. Dan Ehas. Dan, welcome once again, as always. Always glad to have you.
Oh, Tom, thanks so much. It's always great to be here, and we always have such a great discussion.
So let's talk about this. Now, first of all, let's make sure the audience understands that this particular opera that we're going to be looking at, Champion, neither of us have seen it. It only premiered very recently, so there isn't a lot out there in terms of video or history or anything like that. But so what we want to do is kind of set a context for the audience. Let's get started with the fact that this is the story of the boxer Emil Griffith, who was a fighter in the 60s and 50s and 60s, and actually had quite an interesting career.
Yeah, so this is really exciting. I mean, I didn't know anything about him, and fighting is not something that I typically follow, so that name didn't really mean anything to me. But he came from the U.S. Virgin Islands, and I think he won the welterweight championship in like 1958, and you know, he was on a super rise. Evidently, though, through the process of the fight, I think it went 13 rounds, and he was you know, pretty much on the ropes himself. And I think the story that I read indicated that his coach said, "Look, get back in there. If you get him into the corner, just keep hitting him until the referee says you got to stop." Right. And so he did, and he just kept hitting him, and the guy kind of, you know, wobbled a little bit and was not really protecting himself. And then that was the end of that round. I think that was round 12. And then the 13th round, he came out and he collapsed. And then they took him to the hospital, and he died about 10 or 12 days later. Evidently, Emil Griffith tried to see him in the hospital, but they wouldn't let him in. And yes. I think, you know, from that point on, he clearly lived with serious regret. I think it's a perfect story for an opera, because someone has to die. Of course, it's an opera.
Yes.
And there has to be some serious drama. The cool thing about this is that it is within all of our lifetimes, you know, so it's not a historical fiction of some kind. And it is a real story, you know, and it's dramatic. I think another angle that's really interesting is, do you know why people think that he intentionally tried to kill this man?
Yes, apparently during the weigh-in, Bernie Parrott called him a maricón, which is actually Spanish for it's a slur for homosexual. And Emil Griffith's story has that about him, in that he was a closeted boxer, he's a closeted homosexual. And although he claims that he was a sort of a bisexual when he talks about it.
Yeah.
Yes, but that's one of the reasons why a lot of people think that he went in there with just a whole bunch of pent up fury. And when he began to just, you know, start to beat on Parrott in the 13th round and didn't hold back, you know, a lot of people thought, well, maybe that was intentional.
Yeah. I mean, whether it was or wasn't, it happened. And he felt a great amount of guilt about that, and was very remorseful. I don't know if this happened in real life. Well, this part happened in real life. Evidently, when he was a bit older, he was exiting a gay bar and was beaten to a pulp. I think that happened in like 1992. I have put in my notes if that's accurate, but in any case, it was terrible. I mean, why would anybody do that, first of all? And then to an older person, why would you do that? You know, what do you get from it? It's just ridiculous.
Right.
But he was never the same after that, and that exacerbated this thing that happens to, you know, athletes like football players or boxers that get banged in the head a lot. And he eventually began to decline. I think he lived in New Jersey, but was in a, he couldn't care for himself anymore towards the end of his life. And he had an adopted son that sort of was watching, taking care of him. But it's a New York story.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of us can kind of relate to that and the reality of what happened. So there's a lot of drama. It's pretty cool.
Well, it really is. It's an amazing modern story for an opera. And I think it has all the, like you said, has all the elements of that kind of thing. So let's talk a little bit about the composer of this particular opera. His name is Terry Blanchard, and he's really pretty well known in jazz circles.
Yeah, I mean, what I learned, not only did he write, compose Fire Shut Up in My Bones, which was premiered last year at the Met, but he wrote this opera, and he's been doing a lot of film scoring for Spike Lee. I mean, anyone who knows any of his movies, those many of those film scores, I think I wrote some of them down here, Black Klansman, and The Five Bloods. I think there's a bunch of other ones that he's done as well. Mm-hmm. He was nominated for 14 Grammy Awards as well.
Wow, 14.
He's already a Grammy winner himself. He's a jazz musician, and he grew up in Louisiana and happened to be very good friends with Wynton Marsalis and Branford Marsalis. So he's hanging around in good company.
For sure. Down.
His composition teacher was Ellis Marsalis. I believe that's their father. So really kind of an amazing musician. And if anyone who listened to Fire Shut Up in My Bones, you'll get the infusion of jazz idioms within this operatic construct, which is a little, you know, it's like an anachronism. They don't really belong together, but it's cool how they've been infused. Fire Shut Up in My Bones was received so incredibly well. I think this is going to be somewhat similar, at least to, you know, the videos and recordings that I listened to that were available. So,
well, you know, the interesting thing about both of these operas, in fact, is that they are not like brand new operas commissioned by the Met. They've been around for a long time. Champion's been around since 2013, when Terrence Blanchard originally composed it, and it premiered to the St. Louis Opera in St. Louis, Missouri, as did Fire Shut Up in My Bones. So these are operas that as the Met begins to sort of take a critical look at itself through the pandemic and everything like that, they're working for a little bit more diversity and inclusion, because Champion wasn't even on their original schedule for the 2022-23 season.
Exactly. You know, in the New York Times review, I think you and I had shared that, or you shared it with me. One of the things that it indicates is how things are changing at the Met. So not since Strauss has there been two back-to-back operas, two seasons back-to-back by the same composer like that, right? And now you're going to have Fire Shut Up in My Bones as it's going to be remounted, and this year's production of Champion back-to-back. That's the first time, and by the first Black composer to have a work done at the Met, which is pretty amazing, I think. I think the other thing that is pretty cool about the composer and how this all happened. So St. Louis commissioned the opera, I think, and it was premiered in 2013, as you said. But Emile evidently died at 75 in 2013, a month after Champion had been premiered.
Yeah.
I don't know if he knew anything about it or heard about it or saw the reviews, or even if he was cognitively able to understand what was happening. But that's pretty cool to have an opera written about you in your own lifetime.
The interesting thing too about this particular opera is that it's very colorful. There's apparently some really tremendously colorful and wonderful scenes that take place. The choreography, as I understand it, is fantastic.
Yeah, I was looking at the preview videos that are on the Met's web, and it's really it seems really exciting to me. If anyone has seen Into the Heights, this has a lot of that sort of undertone in it, you know, coming from the U.S. Virgin Islands and then bringing that into this opera, infusing it with jazz and other musical idioms. It really is in itself not only diverse because of people's race, but because the music is also quite diverse. You're going to hear blues, you're going to hear jazz, you're going to hear these sort of original kind of melodies and rhythmic patterns that come from the Virgin Islands, you know. In fact, I think this is not the first time, but the orchestra is rather small, but it includes a rhythm section and a trap set, you know, drums are in there, which you wouldn't normally, you don't find that in a Strauss opera.
No.
You know? Yeah.
No, that's true. But the choreography by Camille Brown is just supposed to be fantastic. There's a scene that takes place, as you say, in the St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. And apparently there's also this wonderful scene that takes place in a gay bar. The soprano Stephanie Blythe just plays this bar owner whose name is Kathy Hagen. It's quite the cameo, as I understand.
Yeah. And she's had a long Met career. But kind of an amazing, she's an imposing figure. You know, she's a large woman, tall and quite a character. And she's had a huge career I look forward to seeing her in this because I think she could really, I mean, I can only imagine what she can bring to this character.
The lead, we should talk a little bit about the lead, Ryan Speedo Green, who is playing the young Emil Griffith, the fighter in his prime. He has quite the rich baritone voice. I heard a little sample of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I consider him to be more of a bass or bass baritone in a sense. He has a very good range, incredibly talented young man. I think he's about 37. He had such a troubled life personally. And I wonder, I mean, I'd love to interview him and just see what he can bring from his own personal experience. You know, what he thinks about this. It'll be great to see him in the role because I'm sure that, you know, we talk about emotional recall in terms of acting, right? Mm-hmm. You're the acting professor, but he has a lot to draw on from his own personal experience for this character and how, you know, Emil must have been fighting these demons within. And Ryan has his own demons. When we were talking about this and I looked up to see who the leads were and I saw Ryan Speedo Green, I remembered that there was a CB. I've kind of followed him a little bit because he has a connection with Central City Opera and Opera Colorado, which I have a little bit of a connection with. And so I kind of knew about him from one of the sponsors. There's Dr. Stephen Diltz, who just passed away recently. And, you know, he was thought of very highly in the Colorado area. And I kind of started to follow him. And then he won the Met auditions and he's had a real nice career going on since then. But he would have these, this is from an interview from a CBS special. And when he was interviewed, they had asked about, you know, your background, how did you come to this? Well, he was actually in juvie. Yeah. And then while he was in there, I guess he was in trouble, but he asked his teacher, this is the full length of the story. He said, I walked into the, this classroom and there was this little 5'1" Caucasian curly blonde haired lady. And I sit in my chair and I throw my desk at her and I tell her, I will not be taught by a white woman. And instead of kicking me out of the class, like most teachers would do, and he'd be justified in doing so, she insisted and she instead looked away and then she took my chair and she said, I could learn from the floor. And when I'm ready not to throw my desk at anyone, I could have my desk and I could have my chair back. And she just, from that, her name is Elizabeth Hughes. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, she was sort of his champion in a way. She didn't give up on him. And while he was in solitary confinement, because even in juvie, he could not control his anger. And they put him in solitary confinement and she called him. She was one of the only ones who reached out to him. And he said, I remember getting a phone call and she told me that don't let this moment define you. This does not define you. You can be better. You can do better. That stuck with him. And he was only 12 years old.
Wow. 12. Wow.
He was only 12. The interview is amazing. I won't read all of this stuff, but there's just some amazing stuff that he opens up about. It's very, I mean, he's just very open about the whole episode. But eventually his school went to the Met on a field trip and he saw Denise Graves in Carmen. I mean, what a great opera to see, you know, how exciting. And from that moment on, he knew that he wanted to be an opera singer. He had no idea what all the challenges might be. And his teacher at the time didn't say, oh my gosh, here are all the hurdles you have to get past. They just encouraged him and he flew. I mean, he's 37 years old. He's been singing at the Met, actually Vienna Staatsoper is where he's his main place right now. And he's had a big career starting at a pretty early age, in spite of all the other stuff that came from, you know.
That is an amazing story. It's really great to hear because I think this is his Met debut in a lead role, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. And so to have come all the way from solitary confinement as a 12-year-old in juvie to a career at the Metropolitan Opera House singing. Wow. That is quite interesting. I should also probably let my listeners know that the Met says that people should be warned that there's violence, sexuality, and foul language in the opera. So listeners can take that for what it's worth. Dan, thank you very much for joining me once again and giving us all this great, great background information. I appreciate your research and time. And of course, we will do this again because there are plenty more Live at the Mets coming up.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Champion will be screened at the 1891 Opera House live and in HD on Saturday, April 29th, beginning at 1 p.m. Tickets are $20 general admission, $18 for Opera House members, $10 for students, and is also one of the flexible subscription events. Purchase tickets either online at fredopera.org/tickets or call the box office at 716-679-1891. The Live at the Met series is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy Beaver. Here is the arts calendar for the upcoming 2 weeks. An exhibition entitled Bell, Book, and Candle, featuring the work of visiting professor of ceramics Alora McCullough, is on display at the Emmett Christian Gallery on the second floor of the Rockefeller Arts Center until April 25th. Admission is free. Coming up at the Marion Art Gallery is the Senior Art and Design Show, featuring work for the graduating seniors in the Department of Visual Arts and New Media. The show is in two parts, with the first part running until April 30th and the second part opening in early May. The next 2 weeks feature several concerts at the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia as the semester comes to an end. All concert performances begin at 8 p.m. The Fredonia Symphonic Winds will perform in King Concert Hall on Thursday, April 20th. The Fredonia Chamber Orchestra will perform alongside the Fredonia Free Improvisation Company on Monday, April 24th in Rausch Recital Hall. The Fredonia African Drumming Ensemble will perform on Wednesday, April 25th in Rausch Recital Hall. The Fredonia Chamber Choir and College Choir will sing on Thursday, April 27th in Rausch Recital Hall. The Fredonia Wind Ensemble will play on Saturday, April 29th in King Concert Hall. The Tuba Euphonium Ensemble will play in Rausch Recital Hall on Monday, May 1st. The World Mallet Ensemble will perform on Tuesday, May 2nd in Rausch Recital Hall. The Fredonia New Jazz Orchestra and Vocal Jazz Combo will play on Wednesday, May 3rd in Rausch Recital Hall. And finally, the Fredonia Saxophone Quartets and Ensemble will play on Thursday, May 4th in Rausch Recital Hall. All of these events are free and open to the public. The Lakeshore Center for the Arts in Westfield will be presenting their Spring Fling, a collection of individual performances of humor and joy, on Thursday, May 4th and Friday, May 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. The cost is $15 at the door, cash or check. The Lakeshore Center for the Arts is located on 49 South Portage Street in Westfield, New York. And remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, send an email to operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information. Thank you. If I were forced to select what I consider to be the greatest story ever written apart from the Bible, the story of Romeo and Juliet would probably be right up there. Shakespeare's play about the tragic love affair of these two young people is about as universal and world-renowned as it gets. The Department of Theater and Dance will be presenting the play opening Thursday, April 27th, and running for 4 more performances through Sunday, April 30th. Director Ted Sharon's production offers a myriad of sensation for the eyes and ears.
Joining me now to talk about the upcoming production of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet at the college over for the Department of Theater and Dance is its director, Mr. Ted Sharon. And I should call him Mr. I should call him Professor. Professor Ted Sharon. Professor Sharon, welcome to the podcast.
You can call me Ted, Tom. Tom, you can call me anything you want. I owe you. I owe you that.
Well, I'll just keep it at Ted for now. How's that?
Sounds good.
So, Ted, you know, we have a lot to get talk about with this production because there's so many angles to begin with. But I guess the first thing I'm going to ask you as the director is why Romeo and Juliet of all the Shakespeare plays you could pick?
Well, you and I will remember and love Mac Nelson, who was a professor for many years here in English and was an all-star. And he loved this play as well as Hamlet. Felt it was one of the best there is, one of the greatest stories ever told, and I do too. And I know you've directed this production. Actually, in my tenure here, the last 20 years, you are the only one that I remember directing this show.
Mm-hmm. I think that's correct, yeah.
With yeah. Jonas and with Charlotte and mm-hmm. all that glorious fight work. And yeah,
yeah.
So
I think
the idea of each generation of students getting to see the play live is important. Keeping these stories alive is that great Hadestown line of to know how it ends and still to begin to sing it again as though it might work out this time. You know, the idea of maybe this time they'll get together. Nope, but hopefully somebody in the audience will change their behavior because of what they see, or at least, you know, take a look at what Shakespeare does with the violence and make us look at the awful effects of it and make us think twice when we get up and leave the theater, as Bertolt Brecht would say. You know.
Yeah, let's hope that's the case, because it does have the ability to do that. So let's take a closer look then at what the audience can expect in the production. First of all, let's talk about sort of the concept. What era have you put it in? What kind of visual elements have you added to the show? What will the audience see when they come to see the show?
If I had to define it, it would be a modern setting with a classical influence. The costume, when I saw the costumes, I was beyond thrilled. When I saw the set in design format, I started to cry. Tears came to my eyes in that meeting, and the designers couldn't believe it. I was so thrilled with what they had come up with. There's the majesty of yesterday with the technology of today is what we're going to be able to pull off because of our amazing student designers. And I'm not blowing smoke. I turned to one of the faculty on the design, turned to David, and I said, is this rare? Is this normal? Because this feels special. And he said, yeah, this is pretty, these designers really have done a number on this. So from a costume and a set standpoint, it's a thrust stage, like, you know, we all wish for with Shakespearean productions, so that the fourth wall doesn't exist, so that the audience is engaged 100%. There's inter-audience involvement. There's audience coming up on stage. There's characters in the aisles. You know, I think that's the glory of what we're doing. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning anyway.
Yeah. And how about everybody always wants to know about the leads, Romeo and Juliet. Who are your who are your young actors playing those, yeah, as well as the rest of the cast?
So fascinating story about that. There is a girl here on campus named Juliet, the only one that I've ever seen in my entire time teaching theater since whenever, 1995. And I fought so hard against it in the auditions and callbacks, Tom. I was like, I am not casting Juliet as Juliet. I'm not going to do it. But her parents were prophetic and she won that role. And boy, is she playing it well. And then Aidan Conklin. So that's Juliet Pearson. Aidan Conklin is our Romeo. And he, interestingly enough, is also cast as Romeo in Buffalo Shakespeare in the Park this summer.
Ah, excellent. That's good to hear.
So we've got Juliet as Juliet and Romeo slash Romeo as Romeo.
And of course, one of the things that's always very interesting about Romeo and Juliet as a Shakespearean play, because it has so much, it has language, it has action, the fight choreography. Talk to me about the fight choreography. Who's on board with that? You yourself are a fight choreographer, but I understand you've sort of handed that off.
To all directors and fight choreographers out there, don't direct and fight choreograph your own show. You'll be terrible, as I always am slash would be if I didn't get smart when I was a little younger. Steve Vaughn is the only man for this job. Steve directs shows in Western New York. He also is a fight choreographer here for the last 3 decades or more. You remember being with Steve back in, I don't know when you guys did the Scottish, but when you guys did Macbeth.
Yes, correct.
Forever ago.
Oh, yes. Steve and I go back a long, long way.
So he's the only man for this job. He loves those kids. He's got an iron hand to guide the violence as well as the staging of the violence, which are two completely different things, as you know what I'm talking about. And then Donovan Gale, who's one of our alums, who's here in town, is also assisting Steve with that work. And Donovan is a great actor and fighter in his own right. So Steve and Donovan are taking on that challenge. So we've got the opening brawl. We've got the Mercutio-Tybalt fight. We've got the Romeo-Tybalt fight. And we've got the Paris-Romeo fight at the end of the play. So there's 4 big ones plus things interspersed in between, incidental violence that occurs.
Quite a lot of action. And what about the dances? There's that wonderful party scene in the second act where there's some... some beautiful dancing usually takes place. And then that gorgeous sonnet that's shared between Romeo and Juliet. Who's handling the choreography for you?
So Samantha Kenny, who is one of your and my colleagues here, you actually trained Sam to be department chair before your departure. And Sam is going to do that choreography. And I can't imagine anything better. I saw it last night and there is swirl and there is structure and there is, relationships that are developed during the course of the dance, and then it magically culminates in exactly what you just talked about with that beautiful 14 lines of falling in love.
Yeah, it's really an exciting moment in the play, I always thought. Just really gorgeous and really has to be, handled with a lot of sensitivity and vulnerability. It's a great moment in the play.
Sam does it all. She found, she got gorgeous music for it, and like I said, it's just a swirl of color in my mind as I remember what I saw last night in such a beautiful way.
You've also got unusual situations with understudies and some double casting to give some students more opportunity. Can you talk to that?
So Tybalt, I can't remember the line count, Tom. I think Tybalt has 17 lines or something like that, is all one of the greatest bad guys in Shakespeare, and he only gets a few lines. So a couple of our seniors our seniors always need those capstone roles. So when I looked at the Tybalt thing, I thought, geez, this is a great actor and he's only got 17 lines. What if we swapped the nurse and Tybalt out each night between 2 actors? So if you come one night, you'll see Brian as the nurse. If you come the next night, you'll see Paige as the nurse. And Brian is Tybalt and Paige is Tybalt on the opposite night. So we figured out this swapping thing between the two of them. So they are double cast. And then because of, COVID and the pandemic, we've learned the sad story in theater is we got to cover everybody sometimes twice. So we've got a domino effect ready to go of people who can cover roles, and those covers will go on opening night.
Uh-huh.
So Thursday night is our opening night. in later April here. It would be Thursday,
the 27th
of April is opening. So the covers will go on for that opening night performance to prepare them in the event that they need to be on. Five of them will do it. We have a bunch of other covers as well who are rehearsing and preparing for that, you know, hopeful never to happen night where we all sit in the green room trying to figure out who plays what role because somebody got sick. The horrible thing about the COVID situation is as soon as one person would test positive this last summer and the summer before, you know, you could expect a day later, three other people would be sick as well. So you'd have to cover everything. So we have had to do that. And it adds a whole new landscape to what we've got to deal with in theater, because you are constantly preparing for, you know, the impossible and unpredictable. Hmm.
Yes, I've experienced that myself over the course of the last 2 years or so. It's always a wise thing to have in hand these days. I think the last thing I want to talk about is I understand that you and the cast have created an entire full cinematic score for this show. So it's not only going to be the language and the costumes and the set and all of that, but we're also going to have, you know, a whole score attached to it. That is fascinating.
Well, you started that trend when you were here, the idea of what if we involved cameras in shows? And I'm not talking about adding a camera in Romeo and Juliet, but you started the whole screen thing here many years ago with some Brecht work, right? Szechuan, I think it was.
That's correct.
And that idea has always fascinated me. You were one of the inspirations for me getting really interested in camera work quite a few years ago. So I love the idea of cinema. I love the idea of movies. I love the idea of an actor downstage on the thrust is effectively in a cinematic close-up. An actor way upstage, is in a wide shot, you know, and paralleling those two mediums and bringing them together so it's useful. Having that score underneath it, to me, sitting in the theater is like going to the movies and having that wave of sound underneath stuff that, you know, to add the poignancy, to add the terror, to add the expectation to things. So what we've done is we've assembled previously recorded royalty-free soundtracks all through the script. I spent actually 8 hours yesterday embedding everything in the script so the sound designer didn't go insane. But what it was seven or eight students who will be listed in the program as sound engineers, and they're very proud of it, the actors. We sat in the conference room. We went through tons of options. We laid everything out on the whiteboard, scene by scene, eliminating options, getting down to the best ones, and to a score that we're all really thrilled about. And we started working with it a couple of nights ago. And it just, you know, for an actor to have that music bed behind him is just glorious.
Wow. It sounds like a production that's just going to be a complete feast for the eyes and ears, really, when you come right down to it with the visual effects, the sound, the language, the combat choreography. It's got everything going for it.
We hope so. We'll never compete with yours.
I don't know, Ted, you know, times change, technology changes, and you can always do more than what I had at my command back in the day. But I'm sure it's going to be an absolutely fabulous production.
Now, we've got BFA students, we've got BA students in the cast, we've got everybody from freshmen to seniors with lines. It's a great bunch. We've got some fantastic stage management. I just can't. And I'm not taking up time and I'm not blowing smoke. These people are as professional as I could possibly imagine. I've worked on Broadway shows, you know, multiple Broadway shows, and these students run with the best of them.
Yeah, it's great to hear. That's really great to hear. Does my heart good.
Well, you built this thing. I would invite people to go to the Tada Fredonia Instagram page. They can see some pictures of the set that you and I have been talking about. They can see some pictures of the cast, see some of the amazing designers that have been doing work. It's just, it's inspiring. You know, it gives me, it's my reason to get out of bed right now. You know, it's exciting. to be involved in something like this with such people. It's humbling.
Yeah. Well, it's all coming through, Ted, as it always does. I know that that's always been true in this business of teaching young people theater. It's always exciting. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate your time. And I know it's going to be a success. Romeo and Juliet playing from April 27th through April 30th. We'll get the details out, as we talk a little bit more to finish the interview. But thanks a lot, Ted. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Romeo and Juliet will be performed Thursday, April 27th through Sunday, April 30th in the Marvel Theater at the Rockefeller Arts Center. Evening performances on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday begin at 7:30, with matinees on Saturday, April 29th and Sunday, April 30th beginning at 2 p.m. Tickets are available by calling the Fredonia Campus box office at 716-673-3501. Or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. A couple of closing notes before bringing this Grass is Greener edition to a close. If you weren't able to attend the concert for Dick and Carmen Gilman on Sunday, April 19th, you missed one heck of a good time. The Opera House was filled with great music, as well as tributes to the Gilmans for all their inspiration and dedication to SUNY Fredonia students, the 1891 Opera House, and the community of Fredonia-Dunkirk. It was quite an event, complete with the renaming of the Folk in Fredonia series to the Folk in Fredonia, the Gilman Family Music Series. But all is not lost. The concert was streamed via YouTube live, and you can still catch the concert by going to the Opera House's YouTube channel and viewing the recorded live stream. Check the show notes for this episode at aisleseat.podbean.com for the direct link to the YouTube performance. And before I go, here is your final reminder that registration is still open for the 1891 Run for the Opera House. This year's annual 5K run or walk will take place on April 23rd, 2023, beginning at 9 a.m. You can get all the information you need as well as register online at fredopera.org/the-1891-run. Check the show notes for this podcast for links to the information and registration pages. Volunteers are also needed for the run, so if you'd like to volunteer, please call the Opera House and let them know you're interested. And that's it for this Grass is Greener edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Derek Johnson, Dan Ehaus, and Ted Sharon for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891. Visit the website at www.fredopera.org or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another. Bring it on home, Monroe Crossing.